This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to public radio, which is safe and measured, sometimes maybe a little formulaic sounding, easy to parody. Can you tell me a little bit about your sustainable carpentry? Hard to precisely pin down, but you know it when you hear it, that everybody sounds the same, All Things Edition American Life Companion. You know, that's public radio. This hour, how much does public radio say public? How much does it say white? How much does the force of its vocal tone compel people to sound more white, to sound public radio? What do you think about that? Later this hour, someone who has lived that experience, actually two people if you count me. Did you know that I'm white? Bet you didn't, right? Just like Eminem. Does public radio mean white sounding? Also, the parallel universe of jails in the United States, a warehouse for people, not justice. We'll look at Rikers Island right here in New York. But we begin with a positive trend in the Ebola crisis. The exponential growth of infections seems to have hit a plateau. The World Health Organization says that there were fewer than 100 confirmed new cases of the disease reported last week. That's the lowest since late June. The United Nations Health Agency says beyond simply containment of Ebola, eradication is the next goal. Dr. Emmanuel Darcourt is Senior Health Director for the International Rescue Committee. He just returned from Liberia yesterday. Welcome back, Doctor.
Thank you.
So I noticed right at the top you said, good of you to shake my hand, which says to you that the hysteria back in the United States about Ebola may have diminished a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. One feels a different climate, and the reception at the airport was very professional and I think appropriate from a public health perspective.
What do you think of the World Health Organization's notions that maybe the trend line has moved downward?
I think it's correct, at least in Sierra Leone and Liberia. From what we know, there's been a dramatic reduction in cases, and we're entering a different phase of the epidemic. In Guinea, it's less sure, and there's concern about getting hidden cases that was the reason that the epidemic surged in the first place. But in Sierra Leone and Liberia, there's far fewer cases. However, it's important to note that doesn't mean the epidemic is over. It means it's in a different phase in which a different approach and different types of actions are needed.
What worked to get us to this point?
Well, that's a really important question, John, to find out what worked, because people who don't understand the past are condemned to repeat it, as we've heard around the Auschwitz commemoration. And in this case, if we don't understand what actually beat the epidemic, we are going to have a tough time preventing future ones and even completely ending this one. And the short answer is it's the community. Everyone is saying it. It's crystal clear. It's the emergence of natural leaders within the community and a renewed sense of community purpose around life-threatening, community-ending possibly danger. And communities all over Liberia and Sierra Leone really rallied. In some cases, they got support. I'm proud to say that I feel the IRC was very active in supporting communities. But as one of IRC's own staff said, what really works is when the community is ahead. If you're leading the community into something, that's not going to work. You need to have the community make the decisions about what's working and what's not working.
We talk about this so much, but this is citizen-driven healthcare, and it's in the middle of a crisis. But when the community is mobilized ahead of the doctors and it stops being a top-down kind of thing, real miracles can happen.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's almost more needed in a crisis because as a number of people, especially in public health, have known for a long time, citizen-driven healthcare is what's needed. It's what works best. And in a crisis, you don't have any choice. You have to do things that work. Unfortunately, it took us, the global community, a few months to discover this.
What about the virus has changed?
I don't think that this one has evolved dramatically. I think what's changed is what needs to be done. At the height of the epidemic, at its unprecedented height, we were playing what people called the 70-70 game. We're trying to get 70% of the burials done in safe conditions, 70% of the cases and contacts traced. But now we're in the phase of the epidemic where it's a 100% game, and that's much more difficult. Quality as well as quantity are essential. So the disease is still popping up occasionally. Every one of those cases represents a big danger for reigniting the epidemic. So all over the countries, all over in every health facility, we have to be aware that a case could be Ebola, and we have to be ready, and we have to not miss a single one. And that's a very tall order.
You've talked about citizens mobilized in this crisis, but I'm wondering if the society as a whole feels beaten down to you or confident moving forward, that the one of the permanent legacies might be a sense that disaster can strike at any moment.
I had very long conversations on this trip with our teams in Liberia, but also teams who came to visit from Sierra Leone and even from Mali, and I got a sense of optimism and of strength. And I think it's coming from the fact people know that they beat this virus. Maybe the rest of the world doesn't know it, but it's not the foreign medical teams. It's not the WHO. It's they who did it, and they know that. And I think that gives them a sense of optimism and confidence for the future that I found really inspiring.
That's a remarkable story. Do they dare to believe eradication is within sight?
Absolutely. They're very focused on that. And I heard that message over and over, not only from our staff, but from our partners, that the fight is not over. And they know, just as they knew how to get it, you know, from 500 cases a week to less than 20, they also know how to get it from 20 to zero. And the important thing for us is to listen. There was someone who said, someone who works in the community, and he said, if only people had talked to me earlier on, I could have done so much more.
Just returned from Liberia, Dr. Emmanuel Darcourt is Senior Health Director for the International Rescue Committee with a very optimistic message there. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
It's too early to fully assess the lessons of this Ebola crisis, but one person at least may be certain about experiences he doesn't want to repeat. Dr. Craig Spencer contracted Ebola while working with Doctors Without Borders in West Africa. Dr. Spencer first exhibited symptoms back in October. He eventually found himself at Bellevue Hospital in New York City after reporting a fever. His case, you'll recall, produced a media hysteria worthy of, say, an overhyped blizzard. Mary Harris, senior producer for health reporting at WNYC, was able to speak with Dr. Spencer, who for the first time talked frankly about what he hopes will be different next time. Mary, welcome to the show.
Hi, John.
So how did you find Dr. Spencer?
You know, he's really still recovering from everything he went through. Everything he went through while he was in West Africa, all the death he saw, and everything he went through when he came back here. He really feels violated by everything the press put him through and by the policies that were put in place by the governors of New York and New Jersey.
Let's recall the sort of slip into Ebola that he had personally himself.
When I woke up that morning, I didn't feel quite right. I was breathing a little faster and I felt a little warm and I suspected that maybe I wasn't okay. So I got up and sat on the couch and thought for a second and took my temperature. And it was 100.3, later misquoted as 103, but 100.3. In a way, for that one brief second, it was almost a sigh of relief. Because the moment that I had been fearing and concerned about had kind of arrived, and I felt at that moment like not at peace with being infected, but almost could stop worrying about getting it if it had already come.
Dr. Craig Spencer telling the story of contracting Ebola with Mary Harris for the first time. So I'm wondering if some of that relief came from the fact that, well, I'm not in West Africa. I'm here in the United States. Everything's going to be okay. Didn't work out that way.
Yeah, I mean, definitely that was the relief for him. He speaks specifically about that. And honestly, his guilt at all of the attention he got, all of the treatment he got, and the fact that he couldn't have ever provided that to his patients in West Africa.
What did he find were the problems in the reaction here in the United States?
He was really upset with how the media got things wrong. His temperature, originally reported as 103, actually 100.3. There was some reporting that he lied to health department officials when he first reported his fever. That wasn't true either. Then there were little things, what band he liked, or that he was annoying nurses at Bellevue by playing the banjo, when actually the hospital had given him the banjo as a gift. So that's what really got him angry. What he found was that the difference here was that he had so much care. He had over 100 people dealing with his care. He had a CDC team. But then we, the public, couldn't really deal with the fact that he was an infected person.
It revealed a lot of weaknesses in a few different areas. One, how the media responded and how, at a time when they were responsible for informing the public about the fact that this was not the next pandemic, we weren't at a very substantial risk. In fact, we were at almost no risk. At a time when they were responsible for doing so, they didn't step up and do that. It is true that another concern of mine is that we have set a precedent for poor response to public health threats, not only across the globe in West Africa, where we were extremely slow to respond, but that we responded really poorly in many respects to this threat here in our own country.
Does he feel hurt?
It's a good question. I think that he does. He's a trusting guy. He's a nice guy. And I think he was just surprised at how strong the reaction was.
People thought that I should be, I forget what the exact tweet was, but tried for manslaughter. To this day, I've yet to see anything about my illness or my treatment, anything in the media that has been 100% factual. Everything that I've seen has been either partly wrong or completely wrong.
What does he attribute that backlash to, do you think?
I think he thinks it's the panic. A lot of doctors compare this to the AIDS panic in the 80s. A lot of people forget that in the 80s, Americans actually considered the idea of tattooing AIDS patients so that you knew when that threat was coming towards you. There's a New York Times poll from 1987, 29% of Americans thought this was a good idea. And that was very similar to what happened here. People wanted to know where the threat was. Was it at the meatball shop? Was it on the High Line? But was the threat really there at all? Probably not.
Well, it's a steep learning curve in the United States dealing with these kinds of healthcare issues. And quarantine isn't necessarily the solution. That's the other interesting point.
What the quarantine did is it set in place a precedent where we said, we trust you as a public health professional, as a doctor, as a nurse, as someone who is well enough trained and understanding enough about this virus to go and fight it at its source, but we don't trust you enough to take care of yourself and those around when you get back.
So, fine to go to West Africa, but we don't trust your judgment here in the United States. That's a terrible verdict. And public officials he blames for this in some ways.
Yeah, and you know, I talked to friends about my reporting as I was doing this, and very educated friends, good friends, said, well, but the quarantine was a small price to pay. Of course his fiancée should have been quarantined. Of course we wanted to be careful with nurses like Casey Hickox, who came back and was the first person to kind of get caught up in the quarantine policy in New Jersey. But public health officials really don't agree with this. Ebola, you can't catch it before you have symptoms, and very strong symptoms, not even just fever. Even when you have that small fever, you're probably not shedding virus in a real way that will make you spread it to other people. Right now, we have this measles outbreak in California from Disneyland. You don't see governors getting on television and saying, we need to quarantine the family members of people with measles in their family, even though that disease, it is infectious before you have symptoms.
Ebola became a photo op in Spencer's view.
Yeah.
Mary Harris, senior producer for health reporting at WNYC, with an exclusive interview with Dr. Craig Spencer. You can hear more of that interview at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thanks.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.